Welcome to The Way We Roll with Simon Minty and Phil Friend.
Hello and welcome to The Way We Roll with me, Simon Minty.
And me, Phil Friend.
Welcome, Mr. Friend. Two jabs, Phil, we call you.
Two jabs, Philly Pops. Yes, indeed. My arm is recovering.
You're immune to this stuff.
I've been immune to all sorts of things for years, but now I've got COVID to add to my list of things I'm not going to get.
I'm very happy that you've been done twice. I'm waiting for mine. Does it make you feel any different?
Well, it's a good question that I've been asked that several times now. I don't think I felt worried in the sense of getting it and stuff because I was being really strict about not going out and things. When I had the jabs, I felt relieved, but I wasn't feeling worried before. So, but you know, I do feel relieved. I feel relieved. I'm less likely to get a serious dose of it. And now, since we last spoke, it's become clearer from the science that if you've had the vaccine, you're not likely to spread it either, which is an even better piece of news. So yeah, good stuff. And well, you've not heard anything yet, presumably.
No, because as far as I know, I'm on the ninth because of my age, not related to my impairment. Yeah. You know, my mother and other people say, oh, you got respiratory stuff, but no.
Well, let's hope you're here soon because it would be great. And then we could perhaps even do this live.
Wow, that'd be amazing, wouldn't it?
Nice.
We still do the Zoom calls. Just to clarify, when Phil says he's being careful, he's not left his house for about 9 months. He keeps all his windows closed. He wears masks everywhere. We can't get him out. I just want him to go for a little walk.
I'm known, for the older listener, I'm known as Howard Hughes.
Yeah, exactly.
All the doors are taped up. I'm not allowing anything in. No aerosols. No, it's good, and I'm really pleased. We've been hypercritical of the government in all sorts of ways over the past year, but this is good news. The vaccine coming out is very good news.
You're kicking off first topic.
Yeah, I want to kick off with not a subject that's a lot of fun at all. In fact, quite the reverse. The BBC, they put out a programme on hate crime affecting disabled people. Basically, keeping it very simple, it portrayed five or six different disabled people of different genders, different types of impairments, different life situations, but all of whom had been subjected to unbelievably, I use that word, unbelievably nasty, vicious, either verbal or physical attacks, and in some cases both. And I felt absolutely furious at the end of it. And then I got into an email conversation with a friend of mine who basically put forward a slightly different view. Not that in any way, shape or form was this acceptable, but he kind of asked the question, what is the purpose of these programs? What are they trying to do? We know that perpetrators are absolute swines. We know that victims, particularly the people we met through the program, never in any way, shape or form asked for this to happen to them. Mm. They were completely innocent victims. And what it didn't do was answer any of the questions about, so what, you know, what is going to be done about it kind of thing. So I thought his angle was interesting. He's a non-disabled guy. He's a good mate of mine. And we just got into this little exchange about it. He was, like me, appalled by what he'd seen, but then wanted to know, where does it get us? So that's, and I know you've watched it too, haven't you, Simon? And there was one of the big stories was around a woman who was small, restricted growth, who was assaulted, viciously assaulted, and had a fractured skull and terrible injuries. And this was routine, not the physical injuries weren't routine for her, but the routine of going out and feeling unsafe and feeling that everywhere she went, people would either make some cocky, stupid remark or be, you know, very unpleasant to her. And you know, you and I have talked about this before, but yeah, what was your sense of it? Sorry, I'm going on a bit. It really annoyed me, actually.
Well, but that goes also your friend who said, yes, we're all annoyed, but what now? That's the point. And there is a deep frustration I had at the end of it, which is none of the perpetrators had been brought to justice. And there's a real issue around that. And I'm not saying that's a police issue. Is it a lack of investigation? Is it a lack of ability to prove it? But the fact that this was happening and no one has been got into serious trouble. I watched it and I thought, oh, I'm back in the 70s or the 80s here. That's what you sort of felt, because the level of ignorance. And then you're saying there was one who was talking about issues in COVID. The blind woman who was in the supermarket queue refused entry from supermarkets because of the guide dog and socials, and then people taking stuff out of her basket because she was blind and they think they could get away with it. I mean, this is scum. I mean, I don't know what the right word is. These people are just downright evil, horrible. There was a woman who lived on some form of estate, I presume, and essentially it wouldn't have been all the neighbors, but a chunk of the neighbors were intimidating her increasingly, you know, blocking her entrance, blocking her exit, throwing things at the house. It reminded me years ago, I lived in Brecknock Road. And I remember one day I woke up and there were eggs thrown, and I lived on the first floor, so it was quite high up. Eggs were thrown at my window. And two things happened. One was like, oh, well, now how am I going to clean that? And what was that all about? And then there was this little flash in the back of my head that went, is that because I'm short? Is that because they've seen me? Is that now the start of intimidation? It didn't happen again, but it was a terrifying moment of thinking, oh, I'm going to be victimized here because they've spotted who I am or where I live. The woman with short stature, she'd heard it across the road. I remember this made the press. Someone had said, I dare you to go and kick that midget in the head.
Yeah.
You know, so many levels of offensiveness and that. And then some idiot went and did it. And basically, she's a sociable, bright, engaging woman. And she said, I've lost the confidence now. I have to decide before I go out, can I put my, she used wrestling tights as the description. Am I ready to face this? And how many, two, three of the people have moved house?
Yeah.
They've had to move where they live?
Yeah. One woman, the woman who went blind, just to put it in context for our listeners, there was a woman who went blind. She was working at a reasonably senior level as a housing manager. She lived in tired accommodation as part of her job. She was attacked in the street by people. Her dog was kicked. And she had to decided because of that she would have to leave because the police said that it looked like she'd been targeted and they were following her around. So she gave up her job and was rehoused in a different location. So it was those stories that got me a bit. You know, it was the fact that people's lifestyles had to be completely changed because they'd been attacked and they were the victim. They weren't the assailant.
This is the problem. The woman who had been in the car crash started using a wheelchair. Everyone was saying they're faking it. There's this, you're faking it. And this is why I think these, I'm sorry, I keep using this word scum and I shouldn't, but that's how it feels to me. There's almost like an envy that they're getting money from the state and they're faking it. That's this perverse belief. But she had to leave her house in the middle of the night with the police because they feared for her life. And as they were leaving, people started coming out and even getting aggressive with the police who were escorting her. I'm like, this is our country. This is where we live and there's people like that.
Even that didn't lead to any charges. This woman was rehoused. She had to give up everything she knew. And just as a little tail end to that woman, there was another house on the same estate which had disabled people in it, and that happened to them as well. It was as if the residents on this estate had decided they did not want disabled people living in their area, so they just did everything they could to get rid of them. And there was some bits of information in the program. For example, disabled hate crime doesn't actually exist. There is no offense called disabled hate crime, and a judge can add, if they can show that, you know, the crime was aggravated by the disability issues, then the judge could take that into account when sentencing. That's all very lovely, but if they're not being prosecuted in the first place, they never get in front of a judge, do they?
That goes back. There was a person who's an advocate on disability issues. I think they said he was from Leonard Cheshire. Gradually lost I lost respect for him as it went on. Because he started commentating, I thought, oh, great, we've got an ally, we've got a support here. But gradually, all he was just doing was saying the same that has happened. There was no, I wanted him saying, I banged this door and I bashed that door and I've been saying to these people here and as an organization, we're now campaigning on that. Maybe that is happening. But that was the problem with the program. One, I didn't see the sort of, I wanted more police or people in authority to say, this is what we need to do. There was no nuance to the show in that sense. It was a lot of personal, terrifying stories, but a lack of what's going to happen. Now that, you know, the producers could argue we wanted to raise the issue and then it's for others to do, but that could have been part of the program.
I agree. And in fact, that was one of the points my friend made, you know, so what are we supposed to do then? You know, what comes now? And he made the point that none of the social workers were being interviewed. The police weren't interviewed. There was no advocates against hate crime. We know our mate Stephen Brooks, who's been on the hate crime issue for as long as I've known him. Real, real champion for getting something done about this. And he didn't appear. You know, I really expected to see Stephen Brooks pop up in the middle of this program and give his point of view, but he didn't. So it was a bit, you're right, actually. There was, it certainly shocked me and made me feel all sorts of things. But what he didn't do was give me a sense of there's progress being made to put this right in some way. I was just left feeling absolutely desperate for the people in the films.
This is The Way We Roll, hosted by Simon Minty and Phil Friend.
Right, Simon. Now, next topic I think you're going to take us through is the intergenerational trauma, which sounds very intriguing. Tell us more about that.
Well, it's slightly more than that. I recently went on, I think it was called a racial bias course. The particular trainer is saying, I've got problems with unconscious bias. I don't think it's relevant or valid. And I'm a bit of a fan of that. I have major problems with unconscious bias. However, this was part of a training course that I attended. There were two or three things. I mean, it's a really good course and I enjoyed it. I sometimes felt I was having a very interesting history lesson rather than an organizational action plan at the end of it. That was one issue. However, two or three things just caught me and I thought I'm going to have a chat with Phil about them. One was a phrase called intergenerational trauma. The concept of this is a cumulative emotional and psychological wounding across generations, which includes the lifespan, which emanates from massive group trauma. Now, that's quite a big phrasing. The quickest or easiest routes to that might be, this is often cited in terms of Jewish and the Holocaust. So through generations, you knew what happened to your parents, your grandparents, the great grandparents, and that trauma has stayed with you. So you feel that even though you didn't experience it, but you feel it. I am interested in this in terms of disability. That obviously on this course, this was more about race and ethnicity and could you feel, you know, what happened to people before you? You take part of that identity on. I'm really intrigued on terms of disability. I think the closest we've been talking about disability hate crime, and say you had a form of dwarfism and you spent most of your life being bullied or had a really tough time or your parents weren't supportive or whatever the trauma may have been, A, does that stop you having more children? Or B, if you have children who have a form of dwarfism, would you overprotect them? Would you worry about them because of what we went through? That's a long intro. What do you think, Phil? Just in a little nutshell, if you could. We haven't got much time.
I think my knee-jerk reaction, if I was a small person and had had a tough time because of it,
yeah,
would be to say, yes, I would protect my children if they were also small. I think that would be a natural reaction for me, at least. I don't know what others might do, but I think I might well do that. You know, I've been through this experience and this is what I've learned from it. In order to protect others, I will behave in these sorts of ways. I can see that as a a perfectly valid way of proceeding. Now, whether that helps my children ultimately is another question. But as a parent, and I am a parent, we always want to protect our children. We want the best we can have for our children. So if I can steer them away from painful, nasty things, then I'm going to try and do it.
To bring you back, I mean, it's fair enough, and I did put it up like that, but that's just a sort of tail end example. The concept of intergenerational trauma, do you think it applies to disability? So you have a child, the next one has a child, and they feel what you felt, and it keeps getting passed down the generations. Although the younger ones have never experienced what the older one did experience.
Well, I'm speaking personally now. I had polio as a child, and I went through the experience of being in an iron lung, and that was extremely unpleasant as far as I was very young, so I don't remember great bits of it. But I know that there have been others who before me went through that experience, and I've lived a life, the first part of my life, largely ignoring my disability. I didn't see it as an issue at all. It's only when I started getting into this discussions we have and meeting people who were campaigning on behalf of rights for disabled people, I began to see this as historic disablism. So I didn't see my special schooling as disablest.
Yeah.
In fact, the charity model was well and truly at work for me. I was grateful. Thank you very much. I've got some schooling. Now I look at my schooling as the single biggest lack of, care that society ever gave me. They put me onto basket weaving courses, and what they did for me was to potentially wreck my life, actually, by not offering me the same education everybody else has. Would I pass that on? I'm not sure I would. I'm very clear that disabled people, the history of disability has got all sorts of, let's talk Holocaust. 500,000 disabled people were killed as part of that pogrom. So the history of disability also has some hugely nasty bits to it. Does that affect my view in passing on? I don't know that it does, really.
Let's slightly tweak it. Rather than necessarily your view, I mean, it's slightly hypothetical because you'd have to have a child who had polio, and yes, then you would start behaving in a different, or they would start behaving like you because of da da da. So it doesn't quite apply. But I think the thing that could happen with disability, particularly if you understand the history of disability, do we start playing roles in society as disabled people, because that's how it was seen? So are we probably, you and I, and I know other people who are very strong activists or rights-based, but we become passive sometimes where we really shouldn't be passive. We're just, oh, thanks, or oh, sorry about that. And we're like, no one else would do that, but we do play that partly as a disability subservient, or because it's easier, or we don't want to come across as chippy. So is the sort of what's happened in the past to disabled people then continue, or is it fresh every generation anyway? Again, just a one-line answer would be great.
I'm thinking about my days as a social worker visiting day centres where disabled people were, and looking back on that experience and of their families and how grateful they were to be there. And their expectation was day centre. Their expectation was not jobs. They never expected to work. That was completely off the scale. And that was passed on by their parents. Their parents, who were not disabled, said to their disabled adult child, this is great, isn't it? Coming here, packing crackers every, whatever. It's only when I started looking at that in a more objective way that what I could see handy. It was that wonderful line that we heard all those years ago from, I've forgotten the lady's name, Sue Daniels. I've remembered her name. The soft bigotry of low expectation. This idea that culturally, historically, don't expect much of disabled people because after all, it's enough to get through the day sort of attitude. Now, I think that still prevails. It doesn't quite fit with what you're saying, but no. Do you know what I mean? There's a culture around disability, which is to do with they're lovely, plucky people, they're brave and all that stuff. And let's just give them, let's have a telethon now and again, give them some money and they'll be okay.
And I'm playing with this because it may be wrong. I think that a couple of reflective bits, and I will move on to a new phrase I've got as well, just to keep us going. The bit we may be missing on that is the word trauma. So it's intergenerational, but the concept of this is trauma. Something horrific happened to a previous generation who are like you, and that then comes through to you, even though you weren't there experiencing it. So that's we've got the intergenerational bit, but have we got the trauma bit? The essence of this is that you start with a disadvantage in life almost because you've got baggage from another generation. So you've got to overcome that inside yourself before you're even allowed to get onto the first rung.
I can see why that conversation could go on. I think where I'm feeling the trauma is probably in the medical context of that, whereby you had operations without anybody referring to you. They were done. They caused you months of pain, in some cases years of pain. Some people it never made any difference whatsoever. In my particular case, I had 7, 8, 9 operations where I spent 6 months at a time in hospital, so my education stopped. That had a big impact on me, the idea of having operations where you just, so if I had a disabled child, what would my attitude be to the medical profession?
But also add on, would your child inherit that from you? So do you see what I mean?
Yeah, that's the bit that I'm having the most trouble with.
I mean, what if you left little notes under their pillow every night and it seeped through, or just had a little recording so it eventually got to them?
Yes. And you left scalpels lying around the kitchen table. Oh dear. I don't know. That is such an interesting
question. A great concept. I mean, it's not a great concept, but I think it's an interesting bit in how you might apply it or not.
I suppose the difference is, maybe when you look at the Jewish and the Jewish experience of the Holocaust and so on, it happened to so many people at once in a very short period of time, didn't it? I mean, I'm talking a decade or something. And many of them went through the same kinds of experience. Many, of course, were killed. So that isn't the same as the trauma, in quotes, trauma being experienced by, collectively, the nearest we get to that is perhaps special school, institutional life, that kind of thing. But it's not the same as what the Jews say. And I know we're not trying to compare the two, but you know what I mean? The essence of it.
And that's the point. I mean, don't forget, there are Jewish people that fled and survived, but they've carried guilt because they survived.
Yes.
I remember when I was at university, I met a German guy. So what is this? Late 90s. And he was mid 30s. And he carried guilt for his country's behavior. And I said, how could you feel that? Because you weren't even born. And he went, yeah, but I carry it. It's my country. That's what we did. It's terrible. We'd love to hear from you. It's the intergenerational trauma is the concept. Does it apply? Just one other line they came up with. This is from a spokesperson called Audrey Lorde. I've pronounced that wrong. A-U-D-R-E, and then new word, L-O-D-D-E. She was a rights campaigner. She said there's no such thing as a single issue struggle because we don't live single issue lives. My little quick reflection on that is when people go, could you do diversity training? They go, no, I do disability. And they go, but you could cut. They go, no, I don't. I specialize in disability. So I bang on about single issue. But she's saying we don't live that. So we can't just be solely disability. It's everything.
Yeah, because you're a man too. And you're a white man, aren't you? And you're a straight white man. So there's all those issues.
It's quite a lot of advantages, those ones. They're not.
Well, nearly all of them. Yeah, nearly all of them. I just think it's the sort of thing that people write papers about, isn't it? This, and here I am, special schoolboy, trying to get my head around it. Is it about basket weaving?
I gave you 3 days' notice. I expect you to have written an essay by now, 10,000 words for the next meeting.
I would certainly say it's intriguing. It's an interesting idea.
If you took it across, maybe now I'm thinking, don't worry about the sort of protected characteristics of, you know, our gender or orientation or those other things. If we did it as we're complex, so we care about this and we care about that, we might have a disability, but our politics are this way, or we're fanatical about sport, or, you know, we have disabled Paralympians who don't care about disability rights. I'm generalizing here. So this the idea that you're just a one trick pony isn't right. There's too many other complexities that will come into your life.
Well, and I do think on that, you know, you and I, certainly I started as a disability, you know, awareness trainer. That's what I did. And it was in, you know, 5-6 years into that, that we began to think, hang on a minute, men are disabled, women are, you know, does that make a difference? And of course it does. Of course it makes a difference. And people like Jenny Morris, who were writing about Pride Against Prejudice, you know, women's experiences of disability, did a lot to help. Certainly the early work that I was involved in, it informed me about how that felt. So then we started talking diversity, we started disability equality rather than awareness. So there is much to be, you know, I think there's a lot in that, that we aren't a single issue. You know, I was brought up in a certain way by a certain family, I had a certain class, and that influenced a lot of things. But then I spent many years in hospitals and schools, so that influenced me in a very different way to somebody who didn't go through all that but still had polio like me, you know. So fascinating.
We will put a link up to the trainer, the company. As I said, sometimes you'll read the pre-course work, I felt, was like an academic essay. Wasn't, you know, think about some experiences you've had when you've done this. It's just like, bloody hell. Now, half of me loves that, but the other half of me says, don't forget, we want to make this useful, practical, all that kind of stuff. But
this is The Way We Roll, hosted by Simon Minty and Phil Friend.
It's listeners' corner time.
My favourite bit of the show. Favourite bit of the show.
Quite a few of you have got in contact. Cleo is a person I met on a career development course. She said our podcasts are very good. She admires my drive and resilience. I don't know if that was about just keep making the podcast or working with Phil or maybe something.
Oh, so it's just you that's resilient. And is it? Right, Cleo. Have I got her email address?
When I wrote this, I was thinking, is she talking about both of us? No, I re-looked at it 3 times. She talked about my drive and resilience. So I think, you know.
You got a fan.
My favourite bit was this particular group we'd met on the career development course are still in contact 2 or 3 years later. And I love that. You had that from the people you met.
I did. Yeah,
it's
I did.
Such a lovely
jealous. I'm just being jealous. That's all it is.
Not at all. Don't worry about it. A great friend of mine who I adore, Laura, she's been listening and she said she's binged on them. You know, you do a binge on a Netflix set.
Yeah.
She's binged the Way We Roll podcast. I feel for you, Laura.
Poor Laura.
She said she's learned a lot. She's relatively new to some of the disability history, disability politics, disability identity, and we have given a very accessible, enjoyable way for her to get her head around that. And that's great.
I think Laura could pay us back by writing a paper on it, couldn't she? Perhaps that last item.
She is currently a student, so.
Oh, there you go. You've got loads of time.
Thank you very much, Laura. Appreciate that. Look forward to it. No rush. John Haig, he wrote, the more important thing for you, listener, is that so it was a bit at the end, but he basically says, long time since you both, did we both do this workshop?
Yes, we both did, London Probation Service. I remember John very well.
Senior managers, why has it gone from me? He still enjoys listening to our podcast. My apologies, John. What he did say is, I used to get sent an email. If you are a listener and you're not on our mailing list, when we send the show out, we send a little email out with the link and telling you about the show. That is all that we send out. There's nothing else. So if you want to be part of that mailing list so you get notified, just drop us a line.
Yeah, we'll add you to our list. But it's good to reconnect with John.
Yeah.
A couple for me. One is an old mate of mine that I met when I was on my world cruise back in 2011. His name is Ian Hardwick, and he sent me a WhatsApp message saying, just listening to your show, loving every minute of it, etc. And he listens to lots of them, actually. Non-disabled chap, but we're working on that. I did try and run him over while we were on the ship. I pinned his leg to a wall because my chair got... Remember Nikki Fox said how her chair got out? The same thing happened to me. And Ian pointed that out to me in his saying... Nikki Fox reminded me that you did the same to me. So lovely to have Ian on board.
Was it booze or was the ship tilting? Or
no, it was not booze. It was the chair got stuck and the joystick, just like Nikki described it, got jammed into position and I just went forward and couldn't stop. And poor old Ian was standing by a wall in the dining room. It was very caused chaos, as you can imagine.
Nice here for you, Ian.
Yeah, nice. And Jess Bull, who I should say is my our old friend, Graham Bull, sadly no longer with us, Graham, disabled photographer. His daughter, who happens to be my granddaughter, goddaughter rather, and she said, news to Jess. but she very kindly dropped a note and said, I'm really enjoying the shows and so on. So that was good to hear from her too.
I am friends with Jess through social media and I have it's a weird one because we're both one step removed from you and Graham, but I have an affinity with her because of you and Graham, which I always like.
Yeah, no, Graham's a lovely guy, actually. I still miss him to this day.
Keep it coming.
So I think, yes, that's our listener's corner. Very good.
Where would they?
They can write to us at mintyandfriend@gmail.com. That's our email address.
That is brilliant. And we can get you on our mailing list. And also we're on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, yada, yada, yada.
Before we leave it, if you've got something you think we should talk about, why don't you tell us that as well?
Or keep it yourself. We've got enough going on.
This is The Way We Roll, hosted by Simon Minty and Phil Friend.
Now then, we have a real treat. Simon and I, in the back room, have had lots of conversations about this show and how we can improve it and make it different and all that kind of stuff, haven't we, Simon?
You bet.
And we brought back an old buddy because he's brilliant and he makes us look very amateurish when it comes to broadcasting because he's a pro, been doing it for years. Of course, the remarkable Jeff Adams, Pink. And what we've asked Jeff to do is to dig up some kind of stories, books, poems, whatever. And we're calling this the Cultural Corner. Oh, Cultural Corner. Yes, it's got a little feel to it, hasn't it? Hello, Jeff. Welcome.
I have to say I slightly object to being marginalised to a corner, but there we go. It's your podcast.
Yes. Nobody puts baby in the corner.
But it is the most important corner, Jeff. You're not being asked to go to the naughty corner. This is the cultural corner, Jeff. So what we've asked you to do, Jeff, is to kind of dig up some interesting stuff for us that we could loosely call cultural. And so let's kick off. What have you got? What's your first thing that you wanted to share with us?
Well, the first thing I wanted to share with you was a very, very pleasant surprise that I had on Sunday evening. Sunday evening is normally when Adam Buxton publishes his podcast, but he said he was taking a break between Christmas and Easter. But lo and behold, my phone pinged on Sunday night and said, hey, there's a new episode of the Adam Buxton podcast. Now, the reason I like this podcast is because it takes me completely away from the doom scrolling, the daily, grind of COVID and Trump and all of the things that can make us anxious and upset, and takes us somewhere else to a conversation with somebody that you may not know of, but who's quite interesting. And in this case, it was the comedian Stuart Lee, who I hadn't really come across before, but he sounds like an incredibly interesting guy, very knowledgeable about things like indie music. And I think the reason Adam decided to publish his podcast out of the blue, as it were, is because Stuart Lee is launching a film, or has launched a film by the time you listen to this, on Sky Arts about a Birmingham indie band called Robert Lloyd and the Nightingales. And again, not necessarily my subject of choice, but I was so taken with the conversation and I was so taken with the trailer for this documentary that he's made that I'm definitely going to pick that up on catch up.
Thank you, Jeff. I am a big fan of Adam Buxton too, a huge fan of Stuart Lee as well. He's the comedian's comedian. He's awesome. This sounds a great recommendation.
Yeah, it does actually. I like you, Simon. I'm a big fan. Stuart Lee particularly. I've listened to Adam Buxton a few times. He did Paul McCartney recently, didn't he, Jeff? He interviewed him. And so he has some A-listed people on his show. There's no doubt about that.
He gets some good people and people whose music or other work I haven't yet, you know, discovered. Like, I don't know, Jeff Goldblum or George the Poet. I mean, people who are not necessarily on my radar, but people who are really interesting.
Right.
I also think he's very quirky and he makes all his own jingles, but he also makes you feel part of the show. And it's a really well-produced show, but very natural.
Didn't it start with him taking his dog for a walk and sort of generally... Ramble chat as he went for the rambler, yeah, rambler chats. Yeah.
So you start with a walk with the dog, talks about the weather, sets up the interview, tells you who's coming up, and then you have the main body of the podcast. And then he comes back at the end and says, "Well, that was that, and you know, links to this and links to that, and it's still a rainy day. I'm going to get my dog back home, and goodbye, listeners." And he does it very well, very professionally.
What else you got there, Jeff?
Number two is a new book by John Preston called Fall, and it's about the former media mogul Robert Maxwell. Why should we be bothered about Robert Maxwell, who's been dead for, I don't know, 30 years, I guess, now, near on? And I think the reason is because, again, you know, he was one of those people who... was a bit of a dabbler, a bit of a con man, a bit of a, shall we say, he was economical with the truth and he was very uneconomical with other people's money, especially his own employees' pension funds. I think what interests me about Robert Maxwell is that there are so many parallels between him and Donald Trump. Especially the sort of narcissistic element that, you know, he wanted to be the center of everything. He even when he took over the Mirror, had new carpets made with his initials woven into the carpet, a big letter M. And, you know, he was a very interesting guy. He was a spy for the British. He rose to the rank of captain. He was a Czechoslovakian national until the outbreak of the Second World War. And he almost swindled Rupert Murdoch out of $1 million. He was a very colourful character and a very, very dishonest one as well.
And who wrote the book, Jeff?
John Preston has written the book. It's going to be, I'll give you links to both the audiobook and the hardcover and ebook version of this. And it's going to be the book of the week on Radio 4 as well. So if you don't want to buy it, you can get it for free by listening to Radio 4. I just think it's very interesting to see how these people operate up close, because it's a sort of documentation of megalomania and utter descent into, you know, sort of drowning in his own hype in the end.
I love your reference to him drowning in his own whatever, because he also drowned, didn't he? He fell off his boat or he was pushed or something. Even his death was mysterious.
His death is mysterious, and a bit like the Princess of Wales and JFK, we will never probably know the real truth. People suspected Mossad. I mean, as well as being a media mogul, you know, he was suspected of being a spy. Well, he definitely was a spy for the UK, but he was suspected of being a spy for the Russians. He was suspected of working for Mossad and perhaps, you know, fell out with them over something. But he also, interesting mini fact here, he also had a bit of a sort of thing about urinating from a great height. And one of the theory, I mean, he used to apparently do it from the top of the Mirror Group building in London. You know, in front of invited guests. And one of the theories is that he was relieving himself over the side of the Lady Ghislaine, his ostentatious yacht, and lost his footing and fell over the rail.
Oh, brilliant.
Just the carpet thing. Is it definitely M for Maxwell, not M for Mirror? Do we know that it was definitely his own name on that one?
It was definitely his own name. That comes from courtesy of Julia Langdon, the first woman editor of the Mirror, who he appointed.
There's very few redeeming things that you hear about him. However, these people are fascinating. I mean, there's just something about them that you kind of go, I cannot believe people behave this way. Thank you.
Interestingly, also that, you know, he was a Labour MP. And he very quickly cottoned on to the idea that he couldn't really effect much change as an MP. So he kind of completely switched horses and thought, right, the only way I can really wield power is to influence a lot of people by owning a tabloid newspaper.
Yeah, well,
remarkable.
People have followed his example, have they not?
As you said, Jeff, we will put both the links in with the show. Thank you so much for bringing a little bit of a sort of gear change and some interest. And thank you. I really appreciate the time and the effort.
Yeah, been good. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Cheers, guys.
Well, that was a lot of fun. Good to have Jeff back on the show, Simon.
Yeah, I agree. Jeff sends us text messages every now and again with his sort of cultural picks, so it's nice to have him actually talking about them.
Yeah, it is. Like old times. Anyway, take it easy, and I'll see you very soon.
Hope to hear from your listeners. Thanks very much for listening.
Bye.
This is The Way We Roll, presented by Simon Minty and Phil Friend. You can email us at mintyandfriend@gmail.com, or just search for Minty and Friend on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn.